Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures and puts them into everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today, Judge Gail and I will break down the not guilty verdicts in the nationally followed murder case against Karen Reed in Massachusetts. This was the second trial against Reed after the first one ended a year ago in a hung jury. We also will talk about a pending civil case against Reed and the possibilities of her filing a civil action for a botched police investigation. Judge Gail, a lot going on here. Let me just set the stage for a minute, if you would. The verdict in the Karen Reed trial was the subject of an HBO documentary for the first trial, and the second trial, the verdict was delivered on June 18th. Reed was charged with murder and manslaughter for hitting her boyfriend, Boston police officer John O'Keefe, with her car, giving him a head injury and letting him die in a snow blizzard. After the jury deliberated for 3 days in the second trial, she was found not guilty of second-degree murder and manslaughter. However, she was found guilty of operating a motor vehicle while under the influence of alcohol and received a sentence of 1 year's probation. This was the second full murder trial that Reed faced. The first trial last summer ended in hung jury, a mistrial, which means that the prosecution could try again. And they did. So the second trial started April 1st and lasted 2.5 months. In the second trial, prosecution claims after a night of drinking that outside a fellow police officer's home, that Reed backed her car into O'Keefe, causing head injuries that led him to passing out on the lawn and dying in a snowdrift from the cold. The defense claimed that the investigation was botched by the state and local police, that evidence was fabricated on the part of a police cover-up, and that the prosecution could not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Reed's vehicle ever even struck O'Keefe. So that's the background. Judge Gail, this was a fascinating case to follow. But the first trial and the second trial seemed a whole lot different to me.
They were. And I think to call it fascinating is an understatement. I don't know if you realize this, but I think this has been ongoing for over 3.5 years.
Yeah. January 22 was the incident.
Oh my gosh. This has been absolutely amazing. And again, I want to say part of it is because the victim in this matter, John O'Keefe, is a former police officer. And so of course I think as a society are often concerned about the life of law enforcement who often put their lives on the line for others. But also just, you know, how this entire investigation unfolded and the fact that the first trial was so pitiful on the part of the prosecution.
It was meandering. There was no common thread. It was just a mishmash mess.
It really was. I think there's broad agreement that there's probably a mock trial team of first-year law students who feel they could do better than what took place during the first trial that still resulted in a hung jury. So, you know, notwithstanding all of that and all that experience and even all of the evidence that came out, there wasn't a clear acquittal in the first trial, but there also wasn't a clear conviction in that first trial. And then we had this second trial that came about with the special prosecutor who took over for the first team, if you will, I won't call them the JV versus the varsity, but you know,
it seemed like it.
You can make whatever, you know, deductions you like to by way of reasoning. But here's what I will say is that the presentation of this case during this second trial was, I think, in my view, far more cohesive. And tell me if you agree. I think it's far more cohesive than what we saw in the first trial. It still had blunders and it still had some very interesting points that were kind of dwelled upon. But I think that there were more common threads. I think that thematically it made a lot more sense. I think that it actually moved along at a different clip. It actually wove a story or theme or some umbrella topics together for the jury to follow, notwithstanding the outcome of the verdict. I'm sure
it was a much more tight knit case.
It was a little more cohesive. It was tight. It was a little tighter.
Yeah, I do. Let's back up just one quick step and explain to our listeners. We've explained before, but we get new listeners all the time, how somebody can be tried, have a hung jury or not a unanimous verdict, a mistrial declared, and how they can be tried again, and that's not double jeopardy. Let's give a quick and dirty definition of that.
Yes, because I think some people are probably head scratching and wondering, like, hey, wait a minute, that's not supposed to happen if you've already been through the process before. And generally, the idea is that a person should not face trial for the same offense more than once if the jury deliberates to a verdict. If the individual is placed on trial, the trier of fact is a jury, not a judge, but is a jury of your peers. And those juries are then instructed to deliberate and to return a verdict of either guilt or acquittal or not guilty. And they are unable to do so even after having been instructed or even after being encouraged, strongly encouraged by the court, meaning they're being reminded through a special charge from the court that, you know, the evidence is not going to be any better if there were a different juror, that the jurors are not going to be any smarter or any more intuitive or any more attentive than they are, that they represent the community and the best that the community has to offer and in the best position to make this decision. And notwithstanding all of that, those jurors are still unable to reach a unanimous verdict on those criminal charges, then what results is what we call a hung jury, meaning you have some jurors who may be in favor of conviction on a charge while others on that same charge may be in favor of acquittal, and therefore there's no unanimity. And because you can't get a unanimous verdict on those charges, then that jury remains hung, unable to agree, and they inform the court of that. And as a result, the court declares what is called a mistrial because of the jury's inability to reach unanimous verdicts on those charges. And that can happen if there's multiple charges or if there's only one charge. In this instance, when Karen Reed was charged and tried the first time, the jury returned hung verdicts on everything. And so the jury was unable to agree or convict or acquit on anything, which essentially under those circumstances gives the prosecution the option to decide if they want to try the case again with a different jury. So you don't get to recycle all the same people. So they can try it again with a different jury, or they can elect to not proceed again, believing that the case itself is just not strong enough to reach a verdict. Or alternatively, in some instances, when a jury signals that they're unable to reach a verdict, it also, in some limited instances, kind of inspires an opportunity to resolve a matter with the plea deal. And so sometimes a defendant and the prosecution will be able to reach a resolution by way of a plea in the event that there's a hung jury. Now, that doesn't always happen, but it does, or it can happen. And in this instance, after Karen Reed experienced the first hung jury and the judge declared a mistrial, I don't know whether or not there were serious conversations about a plea deal. I suspect there is at least the intonation of it. And the result was no thank you. And the prosecution, instead of electing to walk away from the case, decided that they would employ a special prosecutor and that they would try the case again, which is why there was a second trial.
And for our listeners, a second trial starts from the very beginning.
And it can be presented that second time from a different perspective. It doesn't mean that the prosecution, you know, gets a chance to come in with a whole new case, with all new evidence, with, you know, this entire, you know, new bucket of what they will present. Essentially, it is the same case, but the prosecution can decide on a different theory of the case. If there is evidence that is, you know, perhaps new or had not been previously disclosed to the defense, then they certainly are obligated to share that as part of discovery. But they can present this same case with this same evidence and information from kind of a new vantage point, which is what we were, I think we're saying, Judge Tom, when we were talking about themes and kind of the thematic effort.
They tightened it up. It was much tighter than it was the first time. First time, like I said, it was rambling all over the place. And this time, the prosecution really focused, I think, on the essentials or the elements of the offenses.
Indeed. So you're absolutely right. It was a lot tighter. It wasn't as rambling. And it, I think, you know, I would venture to say that that first set of jurors were probably left like wondering, you know, exactly what's going on, make this make sense to me. And that's the job of the prosecutor, right? If you're going to bring the case and you're going to ask them to convict someone, especially of such serious charges, you got to make the whole situation make sense to them. And so you can't meander. You can't treat them like Alice in Wonderland and send them down the rabbit hole, right? And expect that they'll emerge from the rabbit hole and have some, all of a sudden, some epiphany about what the prosecution's theory of the case is. I think we've covered this in previous episodes where we talk about how important opening statements are, as well as closing arguments and how you can create those through lines. And if you start off kind of with a theory and a theme, that ought to follow from beginning to end, because you're taking your jurors on this journey and they're trusting you to make this make sense. And I think they probably lost their jury in the first case. And as you so eloquently put it, they tightened it up in this second case.
So I'm looking at what are the pluses and advantages of a second trial. From a prosecution standpoint, I'll let you speak to that in a moment. But from a defense standpoint, from my experience, second trials were easier because you pretty well knew what the prosecution had. There were going to be very few surprises. So you could button up your own case and perhaps hire another expert or two to counteract that. So I think for the defense, a second trial is easier. Would you say that's the same for the prosecution or not?
I would say it all depends. I think that's the answer to everything. I believe everybody likes second chances. Right. Especially if there's no clear cut winner, everybody wants a second chance. The benefit for the prosecutor would be, I think, the pearl in all of it, the pearl in the oyster would be polling your hung jury to figure out where you landed with them. And so if your judge permits you to debrief with those jurors or to poll those jurors, meaning to ask or to figure out where they were voting or where the vote was landing, it really can crystallize for you how close you were to your target or how far off you were. Obviously, for the defense, you only need one holdout, You only need one person to hold out and to hold firm, and you're golden. You don't care if it's a 50-50 break. You don't care if you got two or three people, because you don't need two or three. You only need one. For the prosecution, however, if they see by polling or asking the jurors that, hey, they had most everybody there. They were, you know, with the exception or maybe one or two jurors, that their theory perhaps was working, the evidence presentation was working, everything was there with the exception of one or two people. You may not necessarily know the why, but that can give you some insight. And I've had situations where I've had a hung jury and I would have to really think about, okay, do I want to try this again? And if I had, you know, 11 out of 12 jurors, I, you know, oftentimes my thought process is, you know what, I think I can find one more. I think I could try this case and I could find one more juror because I think it's just that strong. Now, if it's the complete reverse and I have more jurors that are suggesting or intonating or indicating that they would likely acquit the defendant than convict, then I really need to go back to the drawing board. And I really need to think about whether or not this is the kind of case that I really want to try again, because I know for a fact defense would be chomping at the bit to say, you know, right, what, try it if you want to. And right, and I think we could get a slam dunk acquittal next time. So, you know, your case isn't going to get any better, which is true. The one thing I think prosecutors should keep in mind is, again, as I was saying, is anything about the evidence going to change? You know, is it likely that you're going to get new, better, you know, updated or refreshed evidence? Obviously, you're going to have a duty to share that with the defense. And with the evidence that you have, are you going to present it any differently? How are you going to make that make sense to another set of jurors such that you get over the finish line? This really should be a practice of seeking justice, not winning at all costs. And so if you have a case that is not winnable, if your case, I was suggesting this to someone just yesterday that was expressing an interest in becoming a lawyer in a few short years. And I said, you know, when you have a bad case, because it's got a tail that wags. And if your case has a tail that wags, that's a telltale sign that you probably should not be trying to advance the prosecution of that case. It's a dog. And quite frankly, you know, the standard of proof in this Karen Reed case is the same standard of proof we recognize in every criminal case right, across this country, right, beyond a reasonable doubt. And given the hung jury in the first case, and I'm sure as a former defense attorney, you probably agree with me, given the hung jury in the first case, I'm not so certain that even with changing horses, meaning changing prosecutors from case one to case two, that there was necessarily a change in evidence. Yes, even if there's a change in evidence presentation, there's no change in evidence. So just because you changed the leash on the dog don't mean the fleas ain't the same.
There was one change, though, Judge Gale. And that was in the first case, they had the lead investigator from the state police able to testify. In the second case, after the first trial, and it was disclosed, all of his text messages basically defaming the Karen Reed,
the defendant. Yes,
he got terminated, so the prosecution had to make a decision whether to bring him to the stand. They chose not to, so it became less an investigative case and more a battle of experts on accident reconstruction. Some medical testimony as to whether there were appropriate bruises, was there a contact point? So it really became a different case in the sense that you did not have that lead investigator there, which allowed holes to be poked in the prosecution's case by the defense. The defense changed their strategy in the second trial. The first trial, they tried to basically say, somebody else did it. And they were trying to indicate that it was somebody in the house where they were going that night for this after party.
The party.
Committed the offense and framed Karen Reed. In the second trial, they chose not to do that as much and instead just go to the errors in the case. They concentrated and zeroed in on reasonable doubt, and the state failed to prove these elements. And they did that with a slew of experts that were unshakable on the witness stand.
Mm-hmm. Which makes that a really, really tough mountain for prosecutors to climb. And I'll say, even as an aside, when you have cases that are so highly scientific, when they are just so depth with scientific evidence.
This was deep. This was in the weeds.
And when your jurors are not experts, right? So you're calling on your jurors to essentially become experts in these areas and to essentially be, to be taught by the battling experts that will take the stand. You're right that the case itself takes on a different texture, a different tone. It begs a different level of mental commitment from your jurors that that you may or may not have, they may or may not have the endurance, the mental endurance for it for the duration of the trial. And I think it does open the door for the defense to begin to kind of really whittle away at that reasonable doubt. Because if you think about the highly scientific evidence and information that's constantly being presented, and the fact that you now want lay people to retain this information day after day, and the likelihood, you know, just how the human brain works, if that's not your daily experience, then it's not very likely that you're going to retain the bulk of it. It makes it easier then for reasonable doubt to creep in, at least in my view, just from a layman's perspective. It makes it super easy to say, hey, look, if you don't understand it, then it's easy to doubt it.
Well, it was interesting how the defense went about this. They, as I said, they brought on their own experts, but they just picked apart the prosecution's experts and did that in the background of this botched investigation. So the two of them sort of conjoined to cause this specter of doubt. You know, in a trial, for our audience, you're always making decisions. You've got plan A, plan B, plan C, and so forth.
And sometimes D, E, and F, but yes.
Yeah, as you're going through the trial. But the ultimate question, I think Judge Gale alluded to this, is what's going to resonate with the jury? What is resonating at this moment with the jury? Are they bored with this witness? Have they heard enough? Do they not understand this witness, especially when you get into experts? So you really have to hone in on what you think is going to move the jury needle one way or the other.
You're so right. I mean, think about it. After a while, done the experts, and think about your experience when it was a bench trial, right? And if you had,
right,
you know, expert after expert after expert, at some point, when it's especially not your wheelhouse, somebody's going to sound like Charlie Brown's teacher.
Yeah, there's
no doubt that at some point, somebody's going to sound like Charlie Brown's teacher. And when that happens, that usually swings the pendulum actually in the direction of the defense. Because if it is, and we say it here all the time, you don't trust what you don't understand. And if you do not understand it because it is highly scientific, it is, you know, it's latent in a language that you're not familiar with, then that raises the doubt. if you are not familiar with it, if someone is trying to teach you on the fly, if they want you to just take your word for it and to go with it, then oftentimes your gut instinct is to say, wait a minute, I don't know about that. Or I don't know them, and I know what they're saying, but I don't know them. And in this limited experience, I'm expected to trust them and to trust what they say wholesale. Well, again, I believe that, you know, in our experience, what we know is that people don't trust what they don't understand. And that becomes a great opening for the defense. Because that, and that's exactly why they can then raise reasonable doubt and poke holes in reasonable doubt, because what they know now is that the defense or that the jury is not likely, as just as a function of human nature, they're less likely to trust what they do not understand, regardless as to the credentials that may come along with it. Doesn't matter. They're just now hearing this for the first time. And they are also being told by the judge that they're not required to buy into it merely, simply, or only because someone is credentialed. In fact, we tell jurors all the time that you're not required to believe a witness merely because they've taken an oath to tell the truth. Right. There are plenty of people who promise to tell the truth and then turn around and lie.
Right.
And so I think that really does create, and actually it creates a brilliant defense for the defense, because they don't have to work hard to figure out, okay, what's the theme here? The theme is the law. They have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt each and every essential element. And
that's,
we're going to say that they didn't do it, and we're going to prove it because the jury's not going to understand it.
Well, we're not going to necessarily prove it, but we're going to raise doubt that the prosecution proved it. And that's exactly what apparently happened. Three or four jurors have been interviewed by local Boston media here after the trial. And they said what they did was they took each charge and listed on a whiteboard what the elements were of that charge. And then they took the evidence given by the prosecution and what stood after the defense presented their contra evidence, and the prosecution's evidence basically fell away to the point where everybody agreed that there was reasonable doubt. Yeah, so I thought that jury, you know, sort of, you know, they listened and they took notes of discrepancies. That's what resonated with them, discrepancies between the experts. And if the experts are equal and the state has the burden of proof, they lose. And
then
that's what happened.
It goes to the defense. It's the swinging pendulum.
Yeah, yeah, that's what happened. It was funny. Now you're going to laugh at this, because I am not a great predictor of things. But about 4 days before the trial was over, my wife and I were listening to it, and I said the jury is going to find not guilty on murder, not guilty on manslaughter, and they're going to come back with the OMVI, the operating motor vehicle while under the influence, because they want to give something to the state. And sure enough, that's exactly what they did.
Well, you hit the nail on the head with that one.
I did, but you could tell by the evidence. You could tell the holes that the defense was poking in the prosecution's case, and the prosecution's experts didn't come back and refill those holes. They left those holes gaping, in my view.
Which, again, is a huge missed opportunity on the part of a prosecutorial team, especially when you have such a high-profile case, right? Understanding that you are going to have, if you have a very aggressive defense, which Kieran Reed apparently, obviously did have an extremely aggressive defense team, you had to know that they were prepared to literally dissect the prosecution's arguments. And to the degree that they could, they were going to surgically dissect them for the jury, not to embarrass the prosecution, but, you know, obviously to make their point and to zealously advocate for their client, which they did. And understanding that, and I would always say as a prosecutor, you do not ever fully know your case if you cannot anticipate what the defense is going to do. You have no appreciation for your own case if you can't also say, okay, the defense is going to say this, the defense is going to do this, the defense is going to present this, to wit, the state's response should be this, this, and this. If you have not taken those extra steps to do that, then you're just, again, you're waiting for the defense to come along to essentially dissect your case and just leave you there to have your case eviscerated, and to have a jury not believe you. And I've seen that happen, quite frankly, you know, not just in the Karen Reed case. I'll even tell you without, you know, predicting an outcome, part of me, and we did an episode on this a few weeks ago, part of me is kind of uneasy about how the federal government has tried the Sean Combs case and has left to the defense several opportunities to come in and poke holes or to challenge some evidence and information that I believe should have been raised on direct examination that you never leave for the defense to raise. It's the what I call the Band-Aid theory. If it's bad for you, you rip it off, you tell the jury, you get the witness to say it during your direct examination so that it is not a surprise if the defense is mentioning it, because what you want is by the time the defense mentions it, you want it to be old news. You want it to be something that they've already heard before. And I think that the defense in the Karen Reed case masterfully handled that. And I think the prosecution missed a few opportunities and probably a few too many opportunities to do just that.
They made a couple of mistakes, too, because there were holes in the jacket that he was wearing that the prosecution tried to claim were caused by shattered glass of a taillight, thereby proving the collision between the vehicle and the victim, John O'Keefe. However, the testimony had to be corrected by the judge. Those holes were not made by shattered glass. Those holes were made by the investigators who were examining the jacket. And so you've got a claim then of overreach, you know, and the prosecution trying to manufacture evidence, which goes right in the defense wheelhouse, right in the wheelhouse.
And again, there's a difference between misunderstanding and misinterpreting versus misleading. And the expectation at that level, again, given the high profile nature of the case, the expectation is that there is such an excellent command of every single fact of the case that something of that nature would not be misunderstood or misinterpreted, because it will be almost instantly interpreted by the jury as being is misleading, meaning you're trying to mislead the jury into believing a fact that is not a fact, but rather it is a untruth that you are looking to manipulate or to create for the benefit of the prosecution. And you're right, and the judge, you know, can correct it, but it also creates a black eye for the prosecution that didn't have to happen when you have a mastery of all the facts of your case. And you present that. I promise your jury will respect you more if you just tell them straight up front, where everything is, where everything came from, how things came about, as opposed to misstating something that will very easily be interpreted as trying to mislead them, which is no more than just trying to lie to them.
Some of the local attorneys, at least one of the local attorneys that defended Karen Reed, said they knew exactly when they were going to get a not guilty verdict. And it was when that black eye came about on the part of the prosecution, because the prosecution thereby lost credibility. that they know it. Right. So our listeners understand, now that there are not guilty verdicts on both of the very serious charges, the second-degree murder and the manslaughter charge, Karen Reed cannot, I repeat, cannot be tried again for those charges, regardless what evidence may turn up in the future.
No, and even if she decided today that she wanted to give an interview to CNN and be like, suckers, I did it. You guys just got it wrong. It was really me. She's not likely to do that. And obviously her attorneys would counsel her against ever doing something like that. But she is now immune from prosecution on those charges ever again. That is when double jeopardy has attached.
So then it becomes the question, what will the police do? What will the prosecutor do? Will they reopen the investigation? Will they look at perhaps who was framing Karen Reed? Will they look at whether there was a conspiracy among the fellow police officers to cover up something, some act of violence against John O'Keefe? All those are unanswered questions, and this is always the case after somebody's found not guilty. Will the state go after somebody else? And what I'm picking up from local media, Judge Gale, and that's the local Boston media, is that the prosecutor just came out with a statement, his first statement since the trial, saying, I looked at all the evidence and all the evidence pointed to one person who was responsible for John O'Keefe's death, and that was Karen Reed. Now,
well, then the prosecutor should have tried the case itself.
So, well, I'm talking about the special prosecutor, the person who tried the case, said this.
Oh, okay.
Said this. And so what that tells me is he's saying, no, we're not gonna do an investigation. You've got the O'Keefe family, you've got a niece, a nephew, a brother, or parents who are going, look, I guess you said Karen Reed did this, but jury said they didn't. Well, we may believe that they did, but are you gonna try to do anything else? And I think clearly the answer is no. I think this goes in the cold case file.
I think I agree with you. And at the risk of dating myself by saying this, your first question is, you know, what would they do? And I quite frankly think that the prosecutors in this case are going to do, you know, pretty much the same thing the prosecutors in the O.J. Simpson trial did many years ago. And Marsha Clark and Chris Darden, the prosecutors here are going to probably circle up and start writing a book. Because there is nothing else to be said about the investigation in and of itself. They can talk freely about the case and the inner workings of it, but the court has now entertained two trials. They have now investigated this matter, probably to the extent that resources permit them to do so. And I want to pause when I talk about resources permitting them to do so, because I want to talk about just briefly the difference between how cases are investigated and handled at the state and local level versus the federal level. Understand that when cases are charged and indicted at the state and local level, the investigations in these matters are often still ongoing. They're still conducting interviews. They're still often collecting evidence. They're still testing evidence. They're still trying to whittle down whether or not there's more than one suspect, unless it's clearly obvious who the suspect is. They may still be trying to collect statements and the like. And this can all be ongoing even after a matter has been presented to a grand jury and an indictment has already been obtained and the charges have already been determined and the evidence is still rolling in. That is not terribly uncommon. Unlike the federal system, that has a vast amount of resources
And they also have the luxury of having an extraordinarily large swath of law enforcement to support their work. So in many instances, when a case is indicted, charged and indicted at the federal level, the investigation is already complete. They've already had the benefit of interviewing all the witnesses, testing all the evidence, issuing all the subpoenas, gathering all of the information, lining up all of the witnesses. And they have their cases pretty much prepared to try from the time that the case has been indicted. And the investigation is not still ongoing by the time the case is indicted. And in fact, many times when a federal case is indicted, it's not indicted with an eye toward that lower standard of probable cause that we've discussed before. It's indicted with an eye toward the higher standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, because the investigation is complete and the federal prosecutors are looking to whether or not they can actually win this case at trial, which probably goes to why they enjoy such a high win rate at trial. That said, when you think about this case, this state level case, and the fact that it's now been tried twice, and the enormous amount of resources that goes into trying a case once, not to mention twice, I'm not surprised at why they have decided, or at least intonated, that this case is probably going to end up in the cold case file and it's not going to be further investigated, because the amount and the enormity of resources that have been expended, at least on a criminal side. Now, I will discuss what could happen on the civil side a little later, but it does not, but for the criminal side, and as it relates to holding someone criminally accountable for the death of John O'Keefe, I believe that I agree with you that that ship has sailed, that door is closed, that case is closed, and there will be no further investigation and there will be no additional charges brought toward anyone for that death, unless, and we've seen this happen before, there is an admission and there's some hardcore evidence against someone who is unmistakably accountable or responsible for the death of John O'Keefe other than Karen Reed. Because again, it does not matter what you say now going forward. She can't be retried for those charges again. Now, she could be, if they find some different charges, tangentially related, that they're not precluded from that, but they are precluded from bringing these charges back because she's already been tried and acquitted on them.
Another issue that I think we'll do a whole separate episode on for sake of time today, and that is the influence of the crowd that was outside the courthouse in support of Karen Reed by the hundreds throughout the trial, and also claims by the prosecution of witness intimidation, not by the defense or not by the defendant, but by people in support of her through social media. So that's a whole different issue. And I think we ought to talk about the impact of social media on juries and have the whole program on that. But
yeah, and also the engagement of society on cases that are affecting communities, both large and small, right? I mean, right. You would think that for, this small town in Massachusetts, why is there such concern? Why is there such community engagement? And it seemingly started small. And I'll tell you, I want these same folk to come to my rescue if I so much as get a speeding ticket. Because when I tell you, these people are just, they are fanatical. They are committed. They were there like literally every day. In fact, I don't even know who has this kind of time on their hands where they could show up every day to protest for somebody randomly. Like, do you use vacation days for this?
I don't know. It was a cross section of people, stay at home moms. It was retirees. It was people taking time off from work and using vacation time. It was a real cross-section of the community. So
that is absolutely, I want this crowd. If I ever so much as get a speeding ticket, I want this crowd.
There you go. All right, let's move on to the civil side of this. And I want to remind our listeners, civil cases are different than criminal cases. We've talked about a civil case before. It's when one party sues another to correct some wrong, and that wrong is usually corrected by payment of money damages. So in this case, shortly after the mistrial and the hung jury last summer, the family of John O'Keefe, that's the brother, the parents, the niece and nephew that he had custody over, sued Karen Reed for wrongful death of John O'Keefe. And they also, in that same lawsuit, sued two local bars that the Karen Reed and John O'Keefe attended that night, claiming that the bars overserved Karen Reed. She was served seven drinks at one bar, and then she went to another bar and was served two additional drinks after they claimed that she was already overserved. So this case was filed last summer. It was progressing, but it was put on pause for Fifth Amendment reasons, which means that the plaintiff's attorney would want to depose, take the oral testimony prior to trial, sworn testimony of Karen Reed in the civil case. However, that would have been an abridgment of her Fifth Amendment rights to remain silent in the criminal case. So basically, the whole thing was put on hold. But that's an interesting concept. We don't usually see the two cases tracking so closely, do we?
Absolutely not. And I mean, it's just so extremely interesting that that this would happen. But at the same time, I don't know about you. I'm not surprised that a civil case was filed. I'm not surprised that a wrongful death was ultimately filed here. Were you?
No, I wasn't surprised at all, especially after the hung jury. And at that point, recall that the O'Keefe family did not know whether the prosecution was going to actually go after Karen Reed a second time. But for some of our older listeners or some people who are into perhaps ancient history, this tracks the O.J. Simpson case pretty closely, where he was charged with murder of his former wife and found not guilty at trial. But the parents of the victim filed a civil case, and he was found responsible through the civil case. And I think that's exactly what the O'Keefe family is trying to do here.
Absolutely. They're trying to hold her liable for the death, and liability for the death is different from conviction, criminal conviction of the charges. And I think, as you said, as it's strategic, but it's also another tool that's available to the family, if you will, to seek accountability here. And no doubt, it appears that they're doing just that.
Now, they also, interestingly, not only filed for wrongful death, which means basically that through your actions, be they negligent or grossly negligent, you caused the death of another. No criminal liability, but it's a civil case where you're seeking money damages for that loss. In addition to that, the plaintiffs have filed a claim for aggravated emotional distress, claiming that Karen Reed had fabricated a false narrative and that she and her defense team created a conspiracy that is not true and caused the plaintiffs aggravated emotional distress. That's sort of a unique twist.
I'm anxious to see how this plays out, as well as the evidence around this plays out, because again, the standard of proof is much lower. It definitely presents a kind of a unique approach to this argument. But I also, again, think that given all of the emotion and the extended period of time that it's taken this family to get to this point, because remember, all of this has been held kind of in limbo, waiting for the criminal case to resolve. I quite frankly, I don't think that this is going to actually go forward with another trial. I think these folks are just pretty tapped out with the inside of courtrooms. And to what
which ones, the O'Keefes or Karen Reed?
I think both sides are, quite frankly. I think they've all kind of had their feel of the inside of a courtroom. And if there's some way, I think there might be more of an effort, maybe even from the bench, to kind of push this to settle, if there's a possibility to settle. But there may not be a possibility to settle, given that, you know, Karen Reed may be in debt over her head from attorney fees from her criminal trials.
Well, let me just add to that. Karen Reed has lost three jobs since this began.
Wow.
Because of this. She had to sell her home. She's now living with her parents, and she sold her home to try to pay for her attorney fees. And it has been reported by a number of media outlets here in the Boston area that her attorney fees amount to multi-million dollars. So
that's really sad. And again, there may not be a lot of room to resolve with a settlement.
There may not be a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow there.
Right, which also speaks to this other issue, right, of being judgment proof. And the idea of being judgment proof is that even if the O'Keefes are successful, and let's just suggest that they are, let's assume that or presume that they would be successful in their civil litigation and that they win an outcome that is six or even seven figures, there's no way for them to enforce it, at least at this juncture, against Karen Reed, who's right now the first people that are going to be standing in line to have their bills paid are going to be her attorneys. And who knows who else may be standing right behind them to have any other debts satisfied. So depending, if you think of it like a bakery, the O'Keefes may very well have to take a number. And who knows what that number is. And if by the time we get to that number, essentially that amount, that judgment amount is no more than ink on paper, it just means that that judgment is not going to be enforceable as against Ms. Reed. Now, again, she could potentially, yes, take another position, and you could seek to garnish her wages, and you could seek to enforce the judgment perhaps against that through a wage garnishment, but it would be maybe multiple generations before that is ever fully, fully satisfied. Now, the other thing is this, you never can tell the future. It's possible that, right, tomorrow she could go to the local 7-Eleven, buy the luckiest lotto ticket there is, and all of a sudden, she could be one of the richest people in America. It is entirely possible, but it's also entirely possible she could live her life as a regular average person who, as I understand it, I think I was reading somewhere where she also struggles with some really challenging medical conditions, which, right, again, after her attorneys, who knows who's standing in line with the next bakery ticket? It may be her doctors. It may be anyone. And so she may very well be judgment proof. So it won't matter what this exercise on the civil side looks like. It won't matter what they demand by way of a judgment for this case, because she won't ever be able to satisfy it anyway. And so you have to ask yourself, what are you looking for? Are you just looking for the ink on paper in the hopes that one day she does potentially buy that lucky lotto ticket? And as a result of that lucky lotto ticket, you end up maybe possibly one day having that judgment satisfied.
This case, this civil case, will not come up soon because, as I said, depositions, discovery, which is the exchange of information, documents, expert reports, was put on hold. So that's just starting. I would say that we're looking at maybe a year or more before this civil case comes to trial. Would that be a fair estimate?
I think that is absolutely fair. It may even be longer than that. And so if you think about it, this will be, you know, what, a five-year journey, a half decade?
Yeah, at least. Let's talk about the difference in the burden of proof between a civil case and a criminal case. And what can come from the criminal case over to the civil case? Now, let me just read you a quote here that was in a Boston publication here in the Boston Globe. A guy by the name of Thomas Merrigan, he's a retired attorney and state judge, just like us, except here in Massachusetts, said Reed's acquittals on murder and manslaughter charges deprived the plaintiffs in a wrongful death suit of powerful evidence. Reed's conviction for operating under the influence will likely have limited value in the suit. The civil case is about connecting the death of John O'Keefe to her operation of a motor vehicle. He says, I think the outcome of the criminal case certainly illustrates the difficulty, evidentiary-wise, of proving that connection. Now, he's inferring that it would be difficult to even prove that by a preponderance of the evidence, which is the standard in a civil case.
And so for the benefit of our listeners, understanding that preponderance of the evidence is a considerably lesser burden than beyond a reasonable doubt and does not require the same level of proof that you would have to show if you were in a criminal case. Essentially, what you would be required to show by preponderance of the evidence is that that is more likely than not that the claim is true. That's essentially the basic standard, is the more likely than not. That is nowhere near the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, which is far greater, much higher, far stricter, and more demanding than the preponderance standard that just requires the bare tipping of the scale, as opposed to, if you think of it as two scales, as opposed to the beyond a reasonable doubt, which, you know, requires the clear, I mean, the absolute shifting of weight in scales from one side to another. Civil cases use this as a standard, and it's actually the most common standard of proof in civil cases, such as matters like this and personal injury cases and the like. And you have to convince the judge or jury, because you can't have a jury in a civil case, that your version of the facts in the case is more probable than not. So if you think of it in the form of percentages, and if you, you know, think of it as, okay, we start off as equals at 50%, then my responsibility is to tip the scales to 51%. Or maybe to 50.5%, but 51%. That is what preponderance does. It's just almost like a slight tipping of the scale. That's the more likely than not. If you were thinking of that in comparison to beyond a reasonable doubt, and if all things began at 50-50 on those same scales, beyond a reasonable doubt would require that those scales be tipped, one side being 99.99998%, while the other side remained at whatever the difference would be, 0.0001% or 0.1%.
Well, great definition, because the Massachusetts model jury instructions, and that's what judges are to give to juries, say if you would put all the credible evidence on opposite sides of a pair of scales, The plaintiff must prove enough evidence to make the scales tip to their favor. That's all. That's it. Tipping to their favor. I like the way that's put. Ohio's is far more complicated than that. I love this one.
Absolutely. It's far more simplistic and straightforward. It's that, again, it's that 51%, just a little bit. Just tip it, just a little bit.
Okay, so she's got that in front of her. One last thing I want to talk about, and that is there is speculation whether or not she will file suit. And there are lawyers, notable lawyers out of New York and here in the Northeast, who say that she has a good lawsuit against individual officers, state police, and even the prosecutors. They say that she could sue the officers for violating her privacy by doing an investigation that was not complete, inaccurate, and incompetent, and that she could sue the state police for not training their officers to do a competent investigation, allowing an incompetent investigation, resulting in a false arrest. What do you think of that?
I would not put anything past anyone. I certainly, especially given what happened with the chief investigator in this matter, it kind of provides some buttressing to what this could be by way of a potential claim. And, you know, interestingly enough, if there's a strategic move to be made here, were she to file such a matter and it proceed and she succeeds, but I suspect there would be many, many appeals, and she succeeds, because there's a lot of ifs here, it would likely be a potentially a short-lived victory, because any benefit, any financial benefit she derived from that would be quickly absorbed by existing attorney fees, both criminal and civil, as well as potentially, you know, any judgment that she might face from if in fact she were found liable for a wrongful death of John O'Keefe.
Some of these experts are also saying that she could file action against the prosecutors, in this case, the district attorney and the special prosecutor, for malicious prosecution. I've never dealt with one of those because they've always been so far-fetched that they've never come my way. That one gives me real pause.
Well, I can't. What I would say is I would be cautious about any suggestion that the prosecutor or any other elected official might be personally targeted with the lawsuit as a result of them acting on in their official capacity. In many instances, in many states, this is exactly the thing that they are protected against and guarded from. If you think about the independence of the judiciary that is often under scrutiny and under attack, you see judges that are facing heightened scrutiny for, again, acting in their official capacity as judges. And when, and as there often are, rulings that individuals do not agree with, how many times can you expect that those judges might or should be sued personally as a result of that? Now, again, are there instances, you know, when there may be, you know, wrongful detention, wrongful arrest, wrongful prosecution, or some some underlying malevolence to your engagement with the justice system? Absolutely. And those should be perhaps pursued and through whatever channels are appropriate. But I would remain very, very cautious about any effort to engage or to civilly or even criminally pursue officials who are acting specifically in their capacity. Now, if they're in their personal capacity, that's one thing. But when they're acting in their official capacity as elected or appointed officials, I just genuinely get a little heartburn about that, because I do think that there's something to be said about that becoming a slippery slope.
Well, that wraps up our criminal case in the Karen Reed case. I'm sure we will revisit the civil case if it in fact goes forward and does not settle out. It would be an interesting one to follow and compare it to the criminal case as to what evidence is being submitted, whether the theories are going to be any different on the civil side. But we'll keep following that and bring you up to date as it goes along. I don't think it's going to be soon. Again, I think it'll be at least a year or so before that case would ever even see the light of day for a trial. Meanwhile, how do people get a hold of us? How do people listen to us? How are you going to direct them, Judge Gail?
I'm going to invite you all to please check us out anywhere you like to get your major podcast episodes or listen to your favorite podcasts. And that includes our primary sponsor, NPR. So check us out on NPR, on Apple, Spotify, and Amazon. We can be found on all of those platforms. And please don't just listen. We invite you to like our podcast and please subscribe. That way you'll receive notification every time we release a new episode. We look forward to hearing from you, and we invite your comments as well as your questions and suggestions for new episodes, because we genuinely believe you don't trust what you don't understand. And our hope is that we are improving your understanding in our justice system and thereby encouraging you to trust us more.
If you have a question or comment about our podcast, you can always email it to me. That's at hodson@ohio.edu. Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, @ohio.edu. Also, if you have topics you would like for us to cover in the future, we've had a lot of listeners let us know what they want to do, what they want us to talk about, and we've complied so far. So we'll add yours to the list. Shoot me an email with your topic, hodson@ohio.edu. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gail and I will be back real soon to give you new insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.